Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. Tuesday, February the 12th, 2019. And we are ramping up for the 60th running of the Daytona 500 this coming Sunday. You can see the race 2 p.m. on the Fox Television Network. The 60th running of the race and the 40th televised running of the race. So a big year on many fronts. Now, yesterday, we were very lucky to be joined by Ken Squire, the man who broadcast the Daytona 500 the first year it was on, 1979, on CBS, and he was with it through 2000. And he also coined the term the Great American Race, which is definitely what it's become. Now, tomorrow, as we continue to lead up to the big Daytona 500 on Sunday, we're going to have a little Ohio appeal, because a gentleman who will be running in the Daytona 500 from Ohio, Mike Tift, will join us at 12:10 tomorrow. Now, coming up in hour number two today, we're going to be joined by legendary actor. You probably remember him as Charlie Dietz on the hit television series Empty Nest, or maybe Joe Isuzu from the Isuzu commercials. David Leisure next hour, and tomorrow at 1:10, legendary actor, he was Walter Finley on the hit TV series Maude, Bill Macy. So a full week, and 40th Treasurer of the United States, Mary Ellen Withrow, on Thursday from 12 to 2. But this hour, as we continue our prep for the Daytona 500, no better person to be joined by than a man whose family name is synonymous with racing. His son, Dale, and himself, Gentleman Ned, they called him. He has raced stock cars, he has broadcast the Daytona 500, and he is actually synonymous with one of the most famous moments in Daytona 500 history, back in 1993, when his son Dale was running in the Daytona 500. Second race, Dale was going to win. Ned Jarrett, his father, up in the broadcast booth with Ken Squire, here's that magical moment.
There he comes. It looks like he's driving up under him. Earnhardt's car got loose and slid up the racetrack.
Dale Jarrett seeking in. They touch. They come back to the line.
White flag.
White flag and one lap to go. Earnhardt coming back on the outside. Bodine gets into it. Strickland gets into it. This is the finish.
Did we say five cars had a shot at it? Get ready, because it's coming to the wire. There's Jarrett in front.
Jarrett pulling back in front. Bodine comes down to the inside. Jeff Bodine, the 86 champion, trying to find some room.
Come on, Dale. Go, baby, go. All right, come on. I know he's got it to the floorboard. He can't do any more. Come on, take her to the inside. Don't let him get on the inside of you coming around this turn. Here he comes, Earnhardt. It's the Dale and Dale show. It's become off of turn four. You know who I'm pulling for. It's Dale Jarrett. Bring her at the inside, Dale. Don't let him get down there.
He's going to make it.
Dale Jarrett's going to win the Daytona 500. All right. Oh, look at Martha. Oh, dear. Oh, can you believe it?
Way to go.
Oh,
hey.
Man. Did I teach him to drive that race car?
Oh, you think she'll get out of the van, or are you going to go get her out, Ned?
Oh, that poor girl, she needs help.
One of the great moments in Daytona 500 history. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones Ned Jarrett. Ned, how are you?
Doing great. Weather's not so good here in North Carolina today, but it sounds like it's about famous in your part of the country.
Absolutely. Ned, when we go back to Daytona 500, 1993, your son is right there at the end. What was that moment like for you?
Well, it was a very special moment for the Jarrett family, and has turned out to be a historic event as far as NASCAR racing and the Daytona 500 in particular. It just, it wasn't planned. You never know what's going to happen at the end of the Daytona 500, more so probably than any other race. And the producer, Bob Stenner, for CBS that day, had told Ken Squire, and the late Neil Bonnet was working with us also in the booth, and he told him that, well, if Dale Jarrett takes the lead on the last lap, said, you guys back off, and we're going to, Ned called the last lap. Well, I didn't know that he told them that, and so all of a sudden they came on my headset and said, okay, call your son home and be a daddy. And so it was really, really a special moment that I got to to call his final lap of the Daytona 500, and it turned out to be a winning lap, and they were showing pictures of my wife, Martha, Dale's mother, in the van sitting in the infield, and they were going back and forth to that, so I can't imagine how it could have played out any better. And I've always marveled at the presence of mind that the producer and the other people who helped to make it happen technically, and how they came up with it so quick and just as if it were planned weeks in advance. But it was a special moment.
Absolutely. We had Ken Squire on yesterday, and he said in the ear, they just told Ken, they said, lay back and let Ned call this one. And was that just all sporadic in your mind, the call that you were giving as it was coming down to the end?
Well, it just was a natural, spontaneous few words there that I wasn't expecting it. And so I was just, being a dad and trying to make some sense of a broadcast as well. And so the good Lord gave me some words to say, and I guess the right amount of enthusiasm, and it played out very well.
It's a classic moment. Ned, I was doing some research for this program, and one of the sites reported that after the race was over, that you had went to Dale Earnhardt and apologized for how you called that. Is that a true story or not?
It is a true story. It was the next week at Rockingham, North Carolina. That was the next race on the schedule. I didn't get to talk to Dale Earnhardt after the Daytona 500 that day. And so he was on his way to the driver's meeting at Rockingham on Sunday morning, and I ran over and stopped him for a moment. I said, Dale, I need to talk to you for a moment. And he said, boy, congratulations on you guys winning that Daytona 500. I said, well, that's what I want to talk to you about. I didn't treat you right, you and your fans, because there I was on national television calling for my son to win the race and beat you. And I said, that's not right. He said, he just stopped me, and there was a fence between us, and he just stuck his finger through the fence and said, don't you ever forget, I'm a daddy too. And that was a chilling moment as far as I was concerned, and I get choked up every time I tell the story. But the man, he understood. He knew what it was like. He had not won the Daytona 500 at that point, and he just seemed happy that Dale Jarrett was the one that beat him on that day.
Absolutely, and it became a historic moment, and I think we all understood what was going on in your mind there. Ned, that moment is one of the high great moments and ones we all celebrated, and then comes 2001, and again, the mystique of this race turned into an awful day when Dale Earnhardt is killed on the last lap of the race. Where were you, and how did that hit you in 2001?
Well, I was at the racetrack on the infield and sitting in a motor coach watching it at the end, and then I was only a couple hundred yards or so from the media center, and so after almost immediately after the wreck, I went to the media center to learn as much as I could, having no idea that his life had been taken from us at that point, and then a little later, when it was confirmed, Mike Hilton, the president of NASCAR at the time, came into the media center and made the announcement. And I'll tell you, I just my heart just sank. We feared for the worst because it had taken so long to. I mean, and I don't know how long it was, but it seemed like ages, from the time the wreck happened until we learned about it. And it really wasn't that long, but you anguish and you don't know what to expect, and you fear for the worst, and then when the announcement came, I mean, it was a devastating moment for certainly the Jarrett family and myself and all of auto racing.
Absolutely, without question, I think everybody will remember that day from 2001. Yeah. Ned, it's interesting. The 40th televised Daytona 500 will be this Sunday, the 60th running of it. And I was talking again with Ken Squire yesterday. In 1979, the Indianapolis 500 had already been on television. It was a very popular thing on Memorial Day weekend. It still is. But the ratings now are higher for the Daytona 500. A lot of sports are in decline that were heavy in 79. Boxing on television, baseball on television. But NASCAR seems to keep growing every year. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, it's a family sport. I think that says a lot. And also, they're racing cars like people drive on the street. Now, certainly, they've been modified primarily for safety. Most of the things that the NASCAR allows them to do is for safety. And many times when you make a car safer, it'll make it faster as well. And so it I think that combination is why the sport has continued to grow over the years, and I think NASCAR was very fortunate that day in 1979 that a big portion of the country was snowed in, and they had a captive audience, and there was not much else going on, nothing major in sports, and so the ratings were just outstanding for that first Daytona 500, and as a result of circumstances played out the way they did, then it has just every year has become such a special event, and it's mind-boggling really to see what happened on that day and what has happened since then as far as the sport was concerned, because it launched the sport to a great degree to people who had never even thought about tuning into it. And then to have the ending that we had there in 1979, people say, wow, is that what that sport's all about? I need to watch more of that. So it certainly was a great television send-off for it.
You know, it's interesting. One of the most fascinating parts of NASCAR to me is that people now have towels. You know who their favorite driver is. There's decals on cars. There's things in people's homes. Other sports, the merchandising part of it, I think aside from the NFL, are all kind of in a downturn, but NASCAR is in an upturn. I don't know if anybody could name five people who are currently running an Indy, but I know they could name far more than five NASCAR drivers.
Well, they have been portrayed as just down-home people, as Ken Squire, to use his words, common people doing uncommon things out there on the racetrack. And they are people that fans can relate to. And most of them are just genuine, down-to-earth, independent people that just love what they do and work hard at it, and again, they're driving a car that fans can relate to more than any other form of motorsports, and I think that's been a great asset for NASCAR.
You know, Ned, obviously you came into this sport long before television was airing it. You retired before television was airing it. What was the sport's infancy like when you were a part of it?
Well, it certainly was in its growing stages. I had the good fortune of getting in sort of on the ground floor, not so much in competition in the Grand National Division, but see, I raced in the Sportsman Division for 7 years, starting in 1952, before I switched over and clawed my way into and gambled my way into getting into the Grand National side of it, as it was called then, and it was most of the drivers then, they were just common people, and they struggled because there was not much money in the sport then. It was not getting the sponsors. In fact, the biggest sponsor that I remember having in the 7 years that I ran in the Grand National Series came from a Chevrolet dealership in Atlanta, Georgia. Each time I would go there, they would pay me $300 to put their name on the side of the Chevrolet that I was driving. I drove Chevrolets in 61 and 62, and Fords during the other 5 years that I raced in the division. And so you know, there was not a lot of money flowing through the sport at that time, and the drivers and teams would help each other with parts or whatever, and guys like Wendell Scott. I mean, there were several of us that basically supplied him with the parts he needed, although they were used parts, but they was better than what he could go to the junkyard and get. That's what he'd been doing, just go wherever he could get it for practically nothing. And Richard Petty and Junior Johnson and myself, and I'm sure there were others that helped Wendell along the way as well. And so it's just, we all tried to help each other because we were in a sport and that we had needs. And it was a different situation then than it is now because of the money that flows through the sport. And thank God for the big sponsors that have come in and have stayed in the sport over the years.
Being a driver and having a son who's been a driver, what are the skills that are necessary to be a winning driver?
Well, I think that it's like any athlete in any other sport. Now, there was a time when I was driving race cars, there were arguments about whether a race driver was an athlete. And but you have to have a lot of athletic ability to drive a race car and do it for the long periods of time that they have to. And you don't have timeouts like you have in other sports. And so I think that you definitely have to be an athlete. And it is different in the teamwork is different in racing than it is in most other sports. I mean, teamwork is important in any sport. Some of them are more individual, like golf, but still, there's somebody behind you that's helping to make things happen. But in auto racing, there's lots of people involved in every aspect of it because, you know, you got the crews and the crew chiefs and all those people that build the cars and make them go fast and have different ideas and keep trying things and a lot of testing and all that kind of thing. And so it's a special challenge. I think we all, as we grow up, you know, we like cars because that's a way of life. And so we found a big challenge. That's what got me into racing to begin with. It wasn't the speed. I would never consider myself a speed demon or a thrill seeker, but I liked the challenge that was involved. And taking a piece of equipment and fixing it, setting it up to my liking, or at least the way I'd like for it to be, and then go out there and race somebody and try to beat them. I mean, that was a tremendous challenge for me. And I think most drivers would see it that way as well.
As I had said, this Sunday will be the 60th running of the Daytona 500, the 40th airing of it on television. Now, Ned, 1959, the first Daytona 500, you were around. What are your memories of the first one?
Well, I was there as a spectator. I did not race in it. I was in a transition period. I raced in the sportsman division through 1958 and then was trying to move into the Grand National Series, and it took me most of 59 to do that. But I went to Daytona as a spectator, and as been said by practically every driver that's ever gone, when I went through that tunnel, I could not believe my eyes as to what I was seeing. To get on the inside and look back above the tunnel and see the high banking of that track, and it was just so huge, 2.5 miles. We'd never seen anything like that before. And so it was just a feeling that's sometimes hard to describe, but it's one that never leaves you, because I still am in awe when I go to that place and see the track. And, you know, back then, the first time I looked at it, it was really wide. But when you get out there in a race car going upwards of 200 miles an hour, although my top speed was 178 when I was driving, that was because of the way the cars were then, that's fast as you could go. And but if you get out there going that fast, it looks pretty narrow. And I learned too, when you get to 40, back then we'd run 60 cars in the race. And it was sort of a awe-inspiring type of a situation that's really hard to describe, because, you know, get out there with that many cars going that fast and that close together, it's just hard to imagine that it could happen. And then to see how it has evolved over the years with the technology that has come along, and the improvement in not only the cars and the engines and the tires and you name it, everything that plays a part in the sport, and to see where it has come since those days.
You know, Ned, it's kind of interesting. Most sports, the big event is at the end of the season. For NASCAR, it's the first thing. Why do you think that the Daytona 500 over the years has maintained as the race?
Well, I think it's been a blessing for NASCAR, I think, although you're right that most of the time the big event, like the Super Bowl last couple of weeks, was it's their big event at the end of the year as far as football is concerned. But I think NASCAR and the Frances in particular that started this whole deal and built the Daytona International Speedway, they were looking at, hey, we need to showcase our sport the best we can. And what better way to do it than the Daytona 500? And it caught on, and they were right in their thinking, rather than it be the final event. Yes, they would like to have the flair and the all the things that are in the Daytona 500. They'd like to have that in Homestead at the end of the year. But, you know, it's just the drivers and the teams have been away from the track for a couple of months, and you go down there and the fans are hungry to see more action, and you know, everybody's ready to get back to it. And the Daytona 500 is the place to be, and the place that they can go out there and see how they, you know, set the stages for the year.
Absolutely.
I think it served that purpose very well.
I think most would agree. Now, Ned, you retired from driving 1966. You were a young man, I believe, in your 30s. Why'd you retire?
34.
Yeah.
Why did I retire?
Yeah.
There were several reasons. I had broken my back in an accident on a half-a-mile dirt track in Greenville, South Carolina, in June of 1965. And although we managed, we still ran the rest of the race, rest of the season, and managed to win the championship that year. And then the following year, in 1966, things were looking up, and I was leading the point standings again in the early going in April, and then Richard Petty and I were at Darlington, South Carolina, testing tires. And the only communication you had at Darlington at that time was a payphone that sat down at the end of the garage, and everybody used that payphone. That was their, you didn't have cell phones back then, and or computers, and so if you wanted to communicate with the outside world, you used that one payphone that was there. And somebody answered that phone on that day. It rang, and it was Ford Motor Company calling me to tell me that they were pulling out of racing. I knew that they had been in a battle with NASCAR on a car, particular engine, really, that they wanted to run, a double-head overhead cam engine, to compete with the Hemi engine that Chrysler had brought out, and had a lot more horsepower than the Ford engine, so Ford wanted to get equal with them. Well, they went back and forth, so Ford said, okay, we'll take our toys and go home. And they did, and were pulled out of racing. And I got to thinking, boy, you know, just one phone call on a payphone in Darlington, South Carolina can take the rug out from under me like this. I had planned my whole year around having won the championship and with appearances and some endorsements and things of that nature, and it was all down the drain because I couldn't, if I wasn't out there racing, those things were contingent upon me being out there. And one other thing that also played a small role was I have three children, Glenn, the oldest, Dale, the second, and our daughter, Patty, and they were growing up, and I was not, well, Dale was 9 at the time, and our daughter was 6, and Glenn was 15, and I was not able to be a part of their life the way that I wanted to be and the way that I felt that I needed to be. And so I said, well, maybe this is just the time to quit. I set goals for myself and vowed that however far up the ladder I got, I'd quit while I was there. not go down the other side, because people have a tendency to remember you for the last thing you did. And I didn't want them to remember me as a has-been. So I wanted them to remember me as a champion. So I said, the timing is right. I'll just quit now. And so it did.
And I believe the only person to quit the sport as the champion. So it's very interesting. Your nickname, Gentleman Ned, where did that come from?
I don't know. I'm thankful for it. It's been fun over the years. But I don't know. I remember Jim Pascal having said publicly to the media one time, that said you guys call him Gentleman Ned, but said you get him on the backstretch of one of those dark half-a-mile dirt tracks, and said sometimes he's not such a gentleman. I don't know where it came from. I don't know the first person that said it, or just something that just sort of evolved over the years, and it's a nice handle to have.
Absolutely. Now, 1966 brought an end to your driving career, but certainly not your participation in the sport, because here came broadcasting. How did you break into broadcasting?
I was very fortunate to be at the right time at the right place when broadcasting was just getting started in the sport. And there were a couple of guys, Kenneth Campbell, who was the PR director to Richmond Raceway, who's deceased now, and Sammy Bland, a guy who did the PA at Richmond. They started a little network, and when we go on a northern tour, when I was still racing in the mid-60s, we ran about six or seven races up the northeast, and so they would broadcast to two events that were run on Sunday. And they asked me to come up after I did retire, to come up and sit in on those broadcasts. And so that was the first broadcast that I did. And then Hank Schoolfield, who had the Universal Racing Network, thought, well, you know, he sounds pretty good. He might can do this if we train him a little bit. And so he asked me to work on their network. And so I did radio for a few years. And then when Motor Racing Network was formed, I was asked to come over there and join them. And then Ken Squire was the person who helped me to get into television. And he recommended to CBS that they give me a shot at being an analyst. And no other race driver had ever done that. Well, really, nobody had done the radio before I was given the chance. And so anyway, that worked out well, and I've always been thankful to Ken for that. They got the door open for me, and I worked in for CBS for 22 years. And when ESPN came along in the early 80s, I was already working for CBS, but they were only doing seven events a year, and they realized that it was not a full-time job. And so they didn't hesitate to allow me to do the ESPNs. And it was cable and was not really in conflict at that time, cable was not, with the networks. And so they allowed me to work for ESPN, and I was one of the first, in fact, not one of, was the first person. I don't say that boastfully, but I'm happy that it's part of the history of broadcasting and the sport, to be able to work for two national organizations at the same time. I mean, not the same days, but, you know, had contracts with both of those networks. And so I'm very thankful for that. And stayed with both of them. They kept me on until both of them lost the broadcast rights after the 2000 season. And so I decided I would not pursue it any further than that. I'd been with CBS 22 years and ESPN for 19 years. And I said, I've done enough here. So,
It's interesting. You called races on radio and you did it on television. What were the big differences in your opinion?
Well, the big differences are that on radio you got to paint a picture of what's going on television. They can see. In fact, at that time, they wanted the producers on television wanted you to absolutely talk about what was on the screen. I never did adapt that theory too much. But they put up with me with looking out over the racetrack and seeing. I was seeing things sometimes that the camera was not seeing, and so they allowed me to talk about it. But that's the big difference is the that you're talking about what you're seeing on the screen, where on the radio you got to paint a picture where folks can understand what's going on because they're not seeing it.
What was it like when your son came into the sport?
That was another challenge in my life, but a very pleasant one. I wanted to see him get involved in sports because Dale was a tremendous athlete in school and had offers, as the world knows, of scholarship in golf in particular from the University of South Carolina, and he had some other feelers too for scholarships in sports. And once he got behind the wheel of a race car, I knew that that was it. And he knew that that was it. That's what he wanted to do. And so I said, okay. I didn't push him into it, but I always told him, I want you to do what you feel comfortable with and what you feel that you can excel at. And so he chose the sport, and then I got behind him and did whatever I could. And I still didn't, even though we'd won a couple of championships and had some success in the sport, that still didn't make me a rich man by any means, because there was just not that much money in the sport back then. And so I couldn't help him financially. I helped him find sponsorships and things of that nature, but that was my, and you know, cheering him on. And he, Dale and I have always been very close from the time he was a young man. I mean, he was only nine when I retired from driving, but he had gone with me many times, just he and I, to the race. He'd be the one that would go with me to the race. And he wanted to be around his dad, and he wanted to be in a sport, involved in a sport. So it was. And then to see him excel, which did not surprise me. I knew if he ever got in the right situation that he would be able to. I knew in the back of my mind that he would be able to do it, because I knew of his desire and also the tremendous talent that God had given him to do whatever sport he chose to participate in.
You know, it's an interesting time period, the 1990s. Your son is driving, and you are the lead analyst on CBS and ESPN for all the races. Was it difficult to have your son in the race? Did that add any mystique that you were also going to the track on all those days, but you were up in the broadcast booth?
It was another one of those challenges that I had to face, and had to tell myself, hey, you know, you can't talk about Dale Jarrett all the time. In fact, I've been told, or was told many times, about the sport, and even some media people, that you don't do Dale justice. That was my purpose. I didn't want to slight him, certainly, but I'd rather that the other announcers, whatever accolades that he deserved, that they would give them to him, not me having to do it, because I didn't want to. I didn't think it'd be fair to the other drivers for me to. I tried to treat him like everybody else, accepting that I didn't put a lot of praise on him or talk a lot about what he was doing. I let others do that.
Now, interesting thing, another one of these first, not only did your son follow you into the racing business, he followed you into the broadcast booth. Did you give him any advice when it came to broadcasting?
Yes, and it was some advice that was given to me when the thing that finally landed me permanently with CBS, or at least for a long period of time. There were times that they were not sure that they wanted to keep me. And I was being molded by people around me, or trying to, you know, do what they were. I thought they were doing it right, and I was trying to help them. And I went to New York to talk to Barry Frank, who was president of CBS Sports at the time. And he said, Ned, he said across from his desk, he said, I want to tell you something. He said, you don't act like you're being yourself. He said, you're trying to imitate somebody else. He said, you'll never make it in this business doing that. So just be yourself. That's all you have to do. And so I went back home and went to work on that concept, and the rest is history. And that's the thing that I told Dale. when he got an opportunity to get into broadcasting. I said, just don't try to do what anybody else is doing. They're not hiring you to do that. They want you to be yourself out there. And so it seems to have worked well for him.
Absolutely. Now, being a part of the sport, driving in the sport, having this great broadcasting career that went on for many years, and you have come back periodically, you and Ken, and that's been fun to see in the broadcast booth with your son. But when the last race came in 2000, when you knew everything was going to another network and you were not going to pursue that, what was the last race like?
Well, it was sad in one sense. That I knew that I would not be doing it anymore, because it's just like you or anybody else who love their job and would, in one sense, like to do it forever, but know that you can't. Circumstances are going to dictate that. And on the other hand, it was a long career that had been satisfying, and some people said successful. And I guess the fact that it stayed on that long, I guess you'd count that successful. And so you hate to walk away from that, knowing that you wouldn't be doing it again. But I have God gave me a lot of willpower, and when I make my mind up to do something and have thought about it enough that that's what I want to do. And I was thankful that I did get some feelers from not an absolute outright offer, but to see if I wanted to do it again by some of the other networks that came along. But I was at peace with just walking away. And as I said earlier about my driving career, I said I want to go out on my own terms, and I want to go out while I'm on top. And so I didn't feel that I could do much better than what, you know, working with CBS and Motor Racing Network and ESPN, that I could go much higher. So I decided that the circumstances were just right.
Absolutely. Now, we got about 10 minutes left. I want to talk about some people in the broadcast industry and also in the racing industry who you've worked with. What's Richard Petty like, the man who's known as the King?
Well, Richard Petty was a friend when I raced against him, and I'm so thankful that all of my career I was able to race against him. He had started a couple of years before I started driving in the Grand National Series. Now, he started directly in that series where I had run for 7 years in the Sportsman Series. But he was always one of the most fair people that I have ever dealt with. Whatever the dealings were, whether it was racing against him or talking about him in the booth or whatever it was. I mean, he's just a down-to-earth type of an individual. His family was the first that really took a family and made a living from it, built a business from it, treated it like a business, and I just had the highest respect for his father, and certainly that went along with Richard as well, and I'm thankful to say that we're still very, very good friends.
One person who was a great racer, but I think we all miss in the broadcast booth, no longer with us, Benny Parsons.
Benny Parsons was just, well, first of all, he was a friend. We were friends when he started his driving career just as mine was ending, and I was in the first race that he, NASCAR race that he ran in at Asheville, North Carolina, and I met him there, and we just hit it off from the beginning. He and Connie, his first wife, until she passed away, and Martha and I were buddies. We'd go out to eat together when we're at the racetrack, and you know, they were just, he was just like a hometown friend. He was just, and to work with, you could never find a guy who was better than him to work with. You know, I was sort of the I didn't get overly excited about things, and Benny did. That was good. We needed that, and so I just sort of went on an even keel and he'd inject the excitement into it, and it, we just seemed to play off of each other so well. Benny was really, really good at detecting what might be going wrong with a car on the racetrack. My strong suit was more about keeping up with the race on the racetrack and what's going on. And so we complimented each other in that respect. And I would hate to think about what my broadcasting career would have been without Benny Parsons. And I'm thankful that I put in a good word for him to bring him to ESPN.
Absolutely. And the other gentleman who was on the program yesterday, Ken Squire.
Well, Ken is, you know, he wasn't inducted into the Hall of Fame. Not only was that they have an award, the Squire Hall award for excellence in the broadcasting, or not broadcasting, in the media. But he also was inducted into the Hall of Fame. And he's the only media person, or at least the first, to get into the sport specifically on his broadcasting skills. And if it were not for Ken Squire, I don't know if I would have ever made it into television. And he was just such a great guy to be around, and also had such knowledge of the sport and of what the media was all about and the role that it played in the sport. And so he was a great teacher, as far as I was concerned, too, and just a delight to work with.
Ned, when you look back at this career, do you have any regrets?
I'm sorry?
Regrets. Do you have any regrets in your career?
Not really. No, you wonder sometimes how you might have done if you raced longer, but it might be 6 feet under, too. Never know. So as I mentioned earlier, my career paralleled with Richard Petty's early career, and we had raced. He'd raced a few more races before I got started, and so we'd run approximately the same races. And I don't say this in a boastful manner, but the records will show. At the time that I quit, I'd won 2 championships. And Richard had won 1 to that point. He'd won 44 races, and I'd won 50. Well, that's pretty close. And then he went on to win 7 championships. I might not have ever won another race, or maybe not another championship. But you think back, and well, you know, what if? So, but we'll never know that. So that, if that's a regret, yeah, that might be it.
Ned, we look ahead to Sunday, the 60th running, 40th on television. How do you see this coming Sunday?
I think it's going to be a wild race. If Sunday's shorter race was any indication, although they did run pretty calm there for a while, but just one little incident started off and wiped out the field, basically. But you always see that in restrictor plate racing, no question about it. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out on Sunday. You got a lot of young guys with cars capable of winning the race, and that'll be in position that maybe they haven't been before. So I think that's going to help make it exciting to watch, no question about it. And it will not surprise me to see one of those guys win the race, because you got so many of them in there with capable equipment. And then I'm sure the Chevrolet fans are on cloud 9 this week, because for qualifying 4 positions, the first 4 positions was unreal and I think unexpected. So it's good to see them back in the Hendrick organization in particular. So I think it's going to be a really, you don't want to miss race.
Absolutely. Is there one driver to watch, in your opinion? Is there one name that we should be on the lookout Sunday for?
Oh, boy. That is a tough question, especially in the Daytona 500, because the equipment seems to equalize the drivers. And if, you know, Kevin Harvick is always so cagey. he's sort of somewhat of a David Pearson type of a driver. You never know what he's got until the end. Most of the time, I shouldn't say never, but many times you don't know what he's got until the end. And he's a smart race driver, so I'd say that he'd be one to watch.
Ned, from the broadcast booth to the racetrack to your family, you have spent more than a half century in this business. When it looks back on you, you're in the Hall of Fame. How do you hope it looks back on you?
How do I hope it looks?
Yeah. How would you like to be remembered?
Oh, well, as a guy that was sort of straightforward and honest and that people respected.
Fun to watch, fun to listen to, without a doubt, a Hall of Famer. And Gentleman Ned fits him exactly right. Ned Jarrett has been the guest. Now, we do want to let people know, 2 p.m. Sunday, Fox Network, the 60th running of the Daytona 500, the 40th on television. Ned, before we let you go, you have been able to go back up in the booth a little bit the last few years with Ken and your son. What's that been like?
Well, it's been fun, but it's another one of those challenges I always talk about, because when I walked into that booth, the first one we did at Darlington, I couldn't believe the equipment that you have to work with now that we didn't have back then. And I was a little bit lost, to tell you the truth, because I didn't know how all that stuff operated. I'm not a technology type person. and so it was a special treat, and I'm glad I got to do it, but I wouldn't want to do it on a regular basis now.
Well, we loved hearing you and Ken back up there, and certainly your son. Ned, you have great travels and a great time, and it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure talking with you.
Bye-bye.
Ned Jarrett, one of a kind. I tell you what, we're coming back right after this.
Very excited. This is going to be a phenomenal, phenomenal convention, probably the biggest star-studded convention you've ever seen. We've got Gary Busey, Toya Jackson, Jose Canseco, some of the